Okay, let's begin. I effectively just want to start with another notice, which Phil wouldn't have known about. And this notice is concerning our series in terms of the sermons and talks that we have here on a Sunday. Now, if you're regular here, hopefully you're aware that Mike is, he's slowly but surely going through the Bible, and he's called it What We Missed In. Yeah, you're all aware of that? And I think that's due to finish in 2048 or something like that, at the rate it's going at. But that's all great. And so Mike's doing that, and Mike has given the kind of fairly small group of us who speak when he's not speaking a new subject for us to focus on. And I'm the first one today. And what Mike has called it is called connecting with culture. So I said to him, I knew he wouldn't be here today, and I said to him, Mike, I don't want to mess up this notice exactly what this series is about. So can you write something down? Which he did, and I'm going to read it to you, okay? He sent it to me in a WhatsApp, and he explains it much better than I could. So here it is. Mike wrote to me last Wednesday. This is the bit for Sunday. It may be too long, so just take away what you want or add anything. It's actually not too long. I have to say, I think it's very concise and it sums it up. So here it is. Every day we encounter life and interact with our world around us. This happens sometimes on the surface level, a skim over the news, a snatch of TV program or a song. At other times, we interact more deeply, thoughtfully, intentionally, seizing on something which grabs our attention or provokes joy or challenges us to act or makes us angry. Where is our faith in all of these diverse encounters with life and culture? In this Connect with Culture series, we aim to dialogue with, critique, affirm, and sit with the beauty and the brokenness of our world, using books, films, news stories, art, music, podcasts, or whatever. Through the lens of our faith, we will reflect on how these encounters can help us to live more faithfully and more authentically in the world, loving God and our neighbour. You all got that? Because I didn't, and I'm doing the sermon. No, it's not true. That was a very good summary. So I'm the first one to start that. There'll be others who will follow in the weeks, and probably actually looking at it months ahead. Certainly for this term, up until summer when we finish, you know, in August. So it's connecting with culture. Before I start and introduce what I connected with, which I want to share with you. Let's just pray, because that would be helpful for me. And I want just this time, we've got half an hour or so, to be helpful for us all, and hopefully challenging, hopefully encouraging, and needs God's help for that. So let's just pray. Lord, thank you we're able to meet on this morning. Thank you for all our visitors here today. Thank you for bringing us together, kind of a unique group of people in this time. And help me as I speak now, help us as we listen. I ask that your Holy Spirit would bring enlightenment and understanding, encouragement, challenge. Yeah, and this time together that we have may be significant for us all in moving forward and connecting with our world, which is what we want to do, not hide away, but connect with our world and our culture in a way that is pleasing to you and glorifies you. So we ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Right, now, some of you may know, if you know me, that I actually now work in a London prison, and I work with the substance misuse team, which is basically working with men who want to address their alcohol and drug problems. I'm actually based on what we call in the prison the recovery wing, which men can, they choose to come on in order to engage with one of the four courses that we run on the wing, all of which are focused on issues around addiction, recovery, and emotional and spiritual well-being as well. Now, that's not the only course that's run in the prison. There's quite a lot that goes on. But there's one that we particularly encourage the men to consider signing up to when it comes around. And it's this course is called The Sycamore Tree. It's run by the chaplaincy team in the prison. And it actually takes place in the huge chapel that is actually built in the centre of the prison. Turns out the prison where I work is owned by the Church of England. So there you go. What is this course about? It's called The Sycamore Tree. There may be, if you know your New Testament, if you know Gospel of Luke, you may know something about a sycamore tree in there. What's this course about? Well, the publicity and the publicity that they give out describes it as this: understanding the restorative justice process. I read that again. It's understanding the restorative justice process. And it entails, to quote, "The Sycamore Tree is a course which explores the wider effects of crime on victims, offenders, the community, and discusses what it would mean to take responsibility for your personal actions." How does the course work? Well, up to 20 men sign up. There's 6 weekly 2-hour sessions that uses talks, DVD clips, large and group discussions. Actually, not dissimilar to a Sunday morning church service, except they don't sing. Which is not surprising because the course is actually run by the Prison Fellowship, which is a Christian-based organisation. The course is open to anyone regardless of faith. As part of the programme, guests are invited in who come in from outside the prison and they share their experience of being the victim of a crime. I know it's very powerful and affecting because I've talked with guys who have been on the course and I've seen firsthand how it can really quite have a profound effect. I love to listen to podcasts, that's mainly radio programmes on BBC Sounds, I have to say. And so when Mike sent me this, it was a little while ago, and said, you know, you can choose something. My mind went to a podcast which I'd listened to a few times and certainly had an effect on me, and I wanted, in a sense, to bring it into this talk this morning. It was from a series that's on Radio 4. It's called Sideways with Matthew Said. Anyone ever come across that? Maybe not. Okay. This one was about restorative justice. So I'm going to use that podcast, what I gained from it and gleaned from it, and share with you this morning. And this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to sum up the story in the podcast and talk you through it. I'm going to talk a bit about what restorative justice is. I'm going to play some of the podcast, technology willing, and Will has hopefully, well, I said to Will, if it all goes wrong, don't worry, Will, okay. But hopefully we'll be able to just play a couple of clips from the podcast. Then, at the end, you will have a chance to discuss in groups if what I'm going to share not only connects with our culture, but for you connects with Christ. And if it does, how does it connect? So I'm going to ask you to stay awake in this talk now so that you get the chance to talk around your tables about the way you think, or maybe not, or whatever, how this connects with Christ and the Christian faith. Okay, is that all clear? Yeah? Good. So, the podcast focuses on the story of a couple called Ray and Vi Donovan. And it begins on the 25th of May 2001, a warm Friday night. Ray and Vi were at home in Newham, East London, with their 2 sons, Christopher and Philip. Christopher worked hard for a pizza company, and was doing very well in his new job. The two boys went out together for the evening. At 12:40 in the morning, the front doorbell rang. Ray thought it was one of his two sons or both of them having forgotten their keys. It was instead two police officers who told Ray and Vi that they need to go to the hospital ASAP. When they arrived, Christopher was already in surgery. What had happened? The two brothers had been walking home when a group of 14 boys and girls walked towards them. As the brothers passed through the group, Philip was punched in the face so hard that he passed out. Christopher instinctively bent down to help him, but was brutally attacked, kicked, stamped on the head. He was left on a four-lane A road. He was hit by a car and he was dragged 40 feet. He died at 24 that morning. Ray and Vi, we're told in the podcast, talked to him and prayed over his body. But because this was a murder case, the body could not be released. And it was to be 4 months before they could hold a funeral. Christopher died in the May. The body was released in the September. Meanwhile, three of the gang were arrested and charged with Christopher's murder. And the three were aged 15, 16 and 19. All three pleaded not guilty. The first hearing was held at the Old Bailey in February 2002 and the trial officially began in April 2002, which is nearly a year after the murder. Ray and Vi sat through the six-week trial watching from the public gallery, and at the end, all three were found guilty of the murder. In June, they were sentenced. The older two were given life with a minimum to serve of 10 years. The youngest was given a minimum of 6 years to serve. Following the trial, Ray and Vi had tried to rebuild their lives, but they couldn't move on. As Vi said, "We got justice for Chris, but we didn't get the truth. We didn't get an answer to the question, why?" None of those who were convicted made an admission of guilt whilst on trial, and the youngest shouted out that he was innocent when he was sentenced. His father responded by shouting, "Hold on in there and we will get you out." Understandably, this haunted both Ray and Vi. The whole trial had taken an enormous emotional toll. Before going on with their story, which I'm going to come back to very shortly, I want at this point to ask what restorative justice actually is. And to do this, I think we need to be clear as to the difference between criminal justice and restorative justice. Now, at the heart of the criminal justice system in the UK are three basic questions, which are: who did it? What laws have been broken? What punishment do they deserve? Restorative justice goes beyond these boundaries and the limited, if you like, remit of what the criminal justice system focuses upon and entails. Restorative justice has a different perspective, in a sense, regarding justice and focuses instead on the fallout from the crime. So what is meant by restorative justice? Before I'm going to hopefully explain, I'm going to ask, does anyone here have any idea what it may mean? What if you've got some idea, what do you understand by the term? This isn't, you know, like a school lesson where you get it wrong or right. I'm just trying to glean if people have got an idea what restorative justice is. Anyone got any idea? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Restorative justice is ultimately its final sort of in the process is where the victims will meet with the perpetrator. And the victims obviously can include families and everything of people who have been attacked or whatever, or it can just be the victim. Yeah. Okay. On the podcast, Dr. Kerry Clamp, who is Professor of Criminology at Nottingham University, defined restorative justice thus, and I'm going to quote it, okay, so I'm not going to get this wrong, am I, if it's a doctor and a professor. She said this: restorative justice goes beyond criminal justice and should be viewed as an alternative way of exploring and understanding justice based on the following core principles. One, crime is committed against individual people rather than the state. Two, those who have been impacted and affected should have the opportunity to articulate what harm has been caused and what should be done about it, rather than this being determined just by the state and the legal profession. Three, harm should be repaired and any losses restored if possible. And four, there should be a balanced consideration of the needs of the victim and of the offender. The offender needs to be given the opportunity to take responsibility for the crime that they have committed and for the repair of the harm that has been caused. Now, the vital requirement for restorative justice is that the offender admits their guilt before they can participate. So we need to kind of get that clear. It can't happen unless the offender admits their guilt and agrees to participate. So obviously this is something that can never be forced. Now, one of the unique aspects of restorative justice is that it goes beyond the idea of that breaking the law is essentially an offence that is committed against the state. You know, we've broken the UK's laws, so we're going to get punished. It focuses instead on the way that crime is committed against individual people. It's committed against a brother, a sister, a father, a mother. And in doing so, it has the it has the potential to enlarge our conception of what justice actually is and what justice should look like. The state is concerned about one thing, which is this: what laws have been broken? There is a process of investigation of the evidence so that something can be proved beyond reasonable doubt. Then we get a verdict of either guilty or innocent. In the criminal justice system, it is the lawyers who speak for both the victims and for the offenders in the court. Restorative justice rightly points out this: the victim is lost in this process. They do not have a voice. They are, in effect, just represented by the state. And as Akram rightly said, in restorative justice, what is put at the centre is ultimately communication between the victim and the offender. The aims and hopes are that, after a process of careful consideration of risk and need, a meeting in person, either or by letter or video link, takes place. It is actually a radical way of thinking about justice, because it moves away from the focus of justice being solely focused on punishment. Is that clear up to this point? Yeah? We're kind of following it. I know that's a bit wordy, and I had to write this down and really think about it, and I got that from the podcast, but I found that really helpful. So let's get back to the story. And probably for me, the best way to understand how restorative justice works and its potential power is to go back to Ray and Bai's story. So, a year after the court case ended, they still wanted to know why their son had been so brutally attacked. Early attempts at contacting the perpetrators came to nothing, and eventually Ray and Vi wrote a letter to all three who had been found guilty. Their names are Ryan, Stephen, and Philip. Ryan wrote back straight away. And at this stage, they heard nothing from the other two. They discovered years later that Stephen had taken the letter to someone in the prison and said, "I want to write back and I want to meet Ray and Vi," but were told it wasn't possible and that he wasn't ready. It eventually took 11 years for that meeting to happen. And I have to say this, my experience of prison is that everything moves incredibly slowly. And my experience is being rendered powerless in this system is the main aspect of the punishment for the inmate. They are essentially the property of the prison and the probation service. Anyway, encouraged by Ryan's response, Ray and Vi got involved in the restorative justice program that runs, which involved them going into schools and going into prisons, telling their story of how the crime had impacted their lives. And if you like, you know, bringing up the whole thing of the wider consequences of violence. But they still had no face-to-face contact with their son's killers. They had to wait 10 years for this to happen. And the catalyst for this was poignantly the 10-year memorial service for their son, Christopher. Someone at the service knew about a charity called CALM, C-L-A-M, which stands for Confidential and Local Mediation. Ray and Vi were put in contact with them. They were asked, "What would you like us to do and how can we help?" And Ray and Vi poured out their story, poured out their feelings, and expressed this deep wish they had that they wanted to meet the three now men who had killed their son. The charity came back to them 1 month later and said, "We have had contact with all three, we have met all three, and all three want to meet up with you." Now, if this was a movie, we'd probably cut to Ray and Vi meeting all three in the next scene. But the reality is that these things cannot be rushed and they must take time. Why? Well, let's be clear. Restorative justice is not without risk. And the biggest risk is re-victimisation. What happens if the meeting itself distresses and traumatises the victim afresh? Because there's actually no guarantee that the perpetrator will act and talk in, if you like, a restorative way. The guilty party may be resistant to taking responsibility. Safeguards are essential. Care is always taken, particularly for serious cases, and murder is obviously very much in this category. But here is an interesting fact. Restorative justice has proven to be the most effective in the most serious cases. And I think there's much to reflect on there. In the summer of 2011, Ray and Vi began to prepare for their restorative justice meetings. And this is what Vi said, I quote from the podcast. She said, "I decided I wanted to look them in the eye and say that I forgive them. And I cannot believe I'm saying this. But I want to be free. I cannot live with this anger and this bitterness anymore." So, 11 years after their son was murdered, Ray and Vi had their first meeting with those who had committed the murder. And it's important to say this, each meeting happened after they had all served their sentence. All three were now free men living back in the community. The first meeting was with the youngest of the three, Philip, who was 15 at the time, and he's the one who shouted, "I am innocent," and when he was sentenced. This is what Ray said when he met him. "He came in well-dressed, and I thought, that is respect. He sat down in the room, looked at them both and said, I was a 15-year-old coward. I murdered your son. I am sorry. Ryan Vye said that's all they wanted to hear. They just wanted an acknowledgement of the truth and to hear him say, yes, I did this. I am sorry. I'm acknowledging the truth of what has happened, and then show remorse for the action. After that meeting, they had a cup of tea. Tears, tissues, tea and biscuits, as Ray called it, as they talked to each other. And Ray said this, this is where the monster becomes a human being. At this first meeting, Ray discovered that Philip didn't have a job. Ray looked at him and asked, do you want to work? And Philip said, yes. Ray said to him, I will get you a job tomorrow. He rang up a friend the next day and said, I have a man looking for a job. He's an ex-offender. Would you consider employing him? And the friend asked, what did he do? And Ray said, here's one of Christopher's murderers. He's done his time. He is sorry. He needs a break. Will you please help him? Ray said the friend went silent, and then she started to cry, and then she said she'd give him a job. Ray and Vice said they wanted to give him a chance to rebuild his life, to offer help, to tangibly show forgiveness, grace, and mercy. And Ray said that he's now a pillar of society. What about the other two, who are called Stephen and Ryan? Now, at this point, I want you to hear Ray and Vi explain what happened. And to do that, I need to play part of the podcast. Hopefully, technology will be on our side at this point. And I want to start with Stephen, who, after meeting Ray and Vi, actually offered to visit the grave of Christopher as part of his process of dealing with what he did. Stephen had the support of his officer, who's called Sam Fellows, and you will hear her talk first. So when this this goes according to planning, when you hear this podcast first, you'll hear Stephen's probation officer talking about Stephen going to the grave, and then you'll hear Ray and Vi talk about what happened when that happened. So, yeah, just listen to that.
I think Stephen was a little bit anxious about the possibility of going to visit the grave.
This is Sam Fellows. She's a senior probation officer who worked with Stephen, one of the young men who killed Ray and Vi's son. Stephen asked Sam to support him during his meeting with Ray and Vi in 2012. After that meeting, she went with him to visit Christopher's grave.
He was anxious about going to the grave, but I don't think he was anxious about meeting Ray and Vi again. I think they had really reassured him that they genuinely wanted to know that he'd moved on and that they had forgiven him and that they wanted him to have a positive life.
Stephen was the only one with the guts, yeah, to come to Christopher's grave. And he brought some £5 Gary's flowers with him, love his heart. And as he got on his knees in the mud, I said to Vi, let's go for a walk, I can't handle this. We went away, came back 20 minutes later, he was still in the mud, still kneeling there. And I said, get up, Steve, get up. I said, look, we're here, Christopher's here. If Christopher's alive today, he would tell you, get on with your life. And at his grave, so I'm giving you permission to move on.
He just was so keen to show that he wasn't just a murderer, that he was a good person and he could be a good employee and he could be a good partner and he could be a good dad. I think one of the things it really did strike a chord with me was the power of it, that you can genuinely forgive someone and the gift that that gives to you in that it enables you to move forward. It's quite a freeing thing.
The time came for Ray and Vi to meet Ryan, the last of the three. They met on the 3rd of March 2013, 12 years after Christopher's murder.
Now, he said, when everybody ran away, I kept stamping on Christopher's head and kicking him. And with his hand, he described a car going up over the hill and up and over Chris and dragging him. And he said, I still thought he'd get up. I said, well, are you stupid? He said, no, it works in video games. When you're on drinking drugs and your head's not on it, it's like playing these games, he said.
Yeah, so in that room, we said to him, you can't say that. That's not acceptable. We told you we want the truth. He said, no, you don't understand. What I'm describing is an unreal world that I lived in. And I'm describing that to you, but I killed your son and I own that. I did that.
In these meetings, all three men took the blame for the attack.
Because I blame Philip. I said to Philip, no one gets a punch in the face for no reason. We had a stand-up argument about it. And I said to him, who started it? All three told us that in all three meetings, it was us.
We got our answers. We did. And we got them to admit the truth in front of us.
And to apologise.
And to apologise. But that's not going to change that Chris is not here, is it? That will never change that he's not here.
You see, restorative justice is not a fairy tale.
And Ray is obviously right. Restorative justice is not a fairy tale. It's tough to take the risk of offering forgiveness. And it's also tough to face the truth of our actions and take responsibility for what we have done and then say a genuine sorry. But a reminder of what Stephen's probation officer Sam said there in that clip. She said after she saw what happened with Ryan when he went to the graves, or Stephen, I forget. What struck me was the power of it, that you can genuinely forgive someone and the gift of that gives you, for it means you can now move on. In 2018, Ray and Vi Donovan were awarded MBEs for their service towards restorative justice. They travelled the world telling their story. They trained others as to how to bring victims and offenders together in the same meaningful way as they have experienced. And I think remarkably, through their work and the restorative justice work, in 2021, a bill was passed in Parliament for any victim to have the right to receive information about restorative justice and how they can access it. One thing that the research has shown about restorative justice is this: it can be very effective in preventing those who come out of prison reoffending. And that's significant because the United Kingdom has the highest reoffending rate in the whole of Europe. 55% of people come back to prison within 12 months. The mission statement of the charity that I work for is to help to break this cycle of reoffending and lower the rate. I think we should see criminal justice and restorative justice as complementary. We, of course, must detect guilt, and offenders do need to be punished. But there is surely a moral imperative to work at rehabilitation and then work at reducing offending. We must give the victims a voice and also the perpetrator the opportunity to face and tell the truth to those who have been wronged. Three restorative justice schemes were researched by the University of Sheffield over a 7-year period, and it found that it did have a positive effect on reoffending, reducing it by 20%. But restorative justice cannot be evaluated and measured by statistics alone. It's about the emotional and spiritual impact on both the victim and the offender, how they both feel about the process, how they feel about themselves, how they feel about the future. And these feelings are significant, and they can't be measured by statistics. Restorative justice is about us as human beings. And of course, human beings who are made in the image of God. And at the heart of restorative justice is empowerment. How you can have questions answered. How the truth actually has power and can set you free. It gives the victim a voice. It gives the perpetrator the opportunity to face and tell the truth to those they have wronged. Restorative justice ultimately is valued most accurately by the lives and by the testimony of those who have been touched and changed by it. So, I just want you to listen to this amazing testimony at the end. It's a very short clip. Thanks, Will.
Chris, it's Dizzy's legacy year.
We're calling it a legacy, not a memorial.
20 years. And when you think of all the lives that he's touched and the criminals that have had their lives turned around, we get emails all the time from people.
I just thank God for restorative justice because it gave us all the answers and gave us a bit of peace, didn't it? It gave our family peace.
I'll tell you something Stephen said, it's just come to my mind. He said, when Ray and Vi met me, you gave me back my life. And I said, I kind of think you gave us back ours too.
So Stephen said to Ray and Vi, when I met you, you gave me back my life. And Vi answered, I kind of think you gave ours back too. You can't put that into a statistic, but it's a real life illustration of the power of grace, of truth, and of forgiveness. So, I want you around your tables in your groups now, just to have 5 minutes to discuss this. And what I want you to do is, I wanted to ask if what I've shared about restorative justice, and I have to say particularly the story of Ray and Vi, Donovan, resonates with the Christian gospel as you understand it. And if it does, how does it resonate? What is it about the process and story that connects, obviously, to our culture, the culture we live in, but also to Christ? Yeah, you can do that. So just in your tables, our time, but we've got, because of time, we'll do 5 minutes and then we'll just have a little bit of feedback to finish off. Okay, if we could just bring these discussions to a close. I wondered how I was going to finish just this, because I've listened to this podcast many times now, not only to write it all down, but it really deeply touched me and really helped me in the work I do as well. And I was going to read you just something from this book called Love Mercy by Samuel Wells. It's about forgiveness, and he writes about reconciliation as being an icon of the resurrection. And it's beautifully written. So that's what, on Friday, that's what we're just going to hear a little excerpt from that. And then, lo and behold, I read, this is the book we do on Wednesday, okay? And I thought, I better read it, because I may be busy Monday, Tuesday. And I read it, and there's a story at the end of this chapter we're reading that kind of, when I read it, I thought, wow, I've got to read this story on Sunday. It just seemed too much of a coincidence to ignore it. So I'm just going to read you this to finish and then I'll pray. But this story as well, it's kind of a bit similar to Ray and Vi's, but is another powerful story about this freedom that it gives you and the power that's there in forgiveness, which we know is at the heart of the gospel and heart of Jesus' teaching and example. And at the end of this chapter, which we're actually going to look at again on Wednesday from this book, the writer, although he's talking about self-centeredness and sin and everything, he talks about how forgiveness has got the power to really release us from this. And he says this, perhaps you're familiar with the story of Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel, which I wasn't. In February 1993, this is in America, it's an American book, Johnson was told by police that her only son, 20-year-old Lara Minbird, was dead. He had been shot and killed by a boy named O'Shea Israel after a confrontation at a party. During the first months of grieving and into the trial period, Johnson said she believed she had forgiven her son's killer. In her courtroom statement, she said this was because the Bible tells me I need to forgive. But later she admitted the root of bitterness ran deep and anger had set in and I hated everyone. As a minor, Israel was convicted of second-degree murder and given a sentence of up to 25 years. Sometime during those years, Johnson came across a poem about two mothers. One was the mother of a killer, the other was the mother of the killer's victim. To quote Johnson, it was a poem all about the commonality of pain, and it showed me my destiny. It was then she decided to put in a request with the Department of Correction to visit Israel in prison. And what happened next can only be described as miraculous. She said this: "We talked for 2 hours, during which he admitted what he'd done. I could see how sorry he was, and at the end of the meeting, for the very first time, I was able to genuinely say that I forgave O'Shea. He couldn't believe how I could do this, and he asked if he could hug me. When he left the room, I bent over and said to myself, I have just hugged the man who murdered my son. Then as I got up, I felt something rising from the soles of my feet and leaving me. From that day on, I have never felt any hatred or animosity or anger. It was over." In March 2010, Israel was released and Johnson welcomed him home with a big party. Today, Johnson calls Israel her spiritual son, and she carries a locket with a photo of each of her two sons, one on either side of the medallion. Let's just think on that. And yeah, let's just pray now to finish. Lord, we want to thank you for these stories. I thank you for them. I want to thank you for Ray and Vi Donovan for the journey they had to go on and for their amazing testimony of grace, truth, forgiveness, having power. And for that story at the end, when I read it, I thought I had to kind of share that, because that is, as the writer said, is miraculous. And we just ask that power that was at work in Ray and Vi, and that power that was working Mary Johnson, we ask that power be in work in each of us, in the struggles we face in our relationships, maybe obviously none that may be as hard as and challenging as they've had to face, but knowing that we need that power. And to be encouraged that when we ask you for that power, you say you will give us the grace and strength we need. And may we leave in the knowledge that that power is able to set us free. And so I pray you may be at work in each of us towards that end, and help us in the struggles we have when we are hurt and we're pained by others, that we may know that power to forgive, let go, and know your grace and know the effects of it. And we ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen.